You know, when most of us think of the temperature in our homes, we don't like obsess over the wiring in the walls.
Right, nobody does that.
No, we just walk over to the little plastic box, turn the dial, and expect the air to change. But imagine if that thermostat didn't just control the climate in your living room. Imagine if it controlled the price of your groceries,
Yeah.
or the interest rate on your mortgage, the value of the dollars in your wallet, and even, I don't know, the economic stability of a country halfway across the world.
It's honestly, it's a staggering amount of power to conceptualize.
Yeah.
Because the machinery is invisible, right?
Yeah.
We just tend to ignore the wires and the walls until the house gets way too hot or way too cold.
Exactly. And that invisible thermostat is the Federal Reserve. So, welcome to today's deep dive. To help us pull back the curtain today, we're diving into this massive, really professional-grade dossier on the Fed system. It's published by the American newspaper and American TV, and it's freshly updated for our current economic reality as of June 2026.
It's a great set of sources.
It really is. And the mission today is to completely demystify this institution because the Fed is not just some boring government bank, and it's certainly not a magical money printing machine. It is literally the operating architecture of global dollar
Well,
capitalism.
and I mean, that means it affects literally every listener tuning in,
Right.
whether you are currently trying to buy a house or save for retirement, or maybe you're dabbling in crypto or just, trying to budget for your weekly grocery run. The Fed's hands are indirectly shaping the prices of all those things. You really cannot understand your own financial life without understanding the mechanics of this institution.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because to understand why this one organization has such complex, sweeping power over our daily lives today, we first have to look at the absolute historical chaos that forced its creation.
Yeah, the backstory is wild.
We have to go back to the world before 1913.
Right, so pre-1913, America was an absolute industrial powerhouse, but its financial system was, well, it was incredibly fragile. The main issue was that banking authority was entirely fragmented. You had state banks, national banks, private clearinghouses, just all over the place. And crucially, the United States had no elastic currency.
See, I'm struggling to picture this. If I'm a farmer in, say, 1905, and I suddenly need cash to pay workers to move my harvest, why couldn't the local bank just accommodate that? Why was the currency considered inelastic?
Because the supply of money was rigidly tied to gold reserves and very specific government bonds.
Yeah.
It couldn't smoothly expand or contract based on what the real economy actually needed. So during harvest season, thousands of farmers would suddenly demand physical cash all at once. But local country banks didn't keep all that cash in their own vaults.
Wait, they didn't.
No, they kept it in larger city banks to earn interest. The sources refer to these as correspondent banks.
So they're essentially passing the buck up the chain.
Right, exactly. And those city banks passed it up to Wall Street banks, creating what financial historians call pyramids of liquidity. The base of the pyramid is massive, but the actual physical cash is concentrated at the very top.
Oh, wow.
And it was usually loaned out to stock market speculators. So when harvest season hit, the country banks demanded their cash back from the city banks, who demanded it from Wall Street. That sudden seasonal demand would just drain liquidity from the entire system.
That sounds incredibly brittle.
It was. If a war scare happened or, an asset bubble burst at the exact same time, people would panic and rush to withdraw their deposits. The entire pyramid would just fracture. Banks would simply refuse to hand over cash.
Jeez.
Fire sales would start, and credit would violently contract.
Which sets the stage for the Panic of 1907, right? The sources highlight this as the real breaking point.
Yeah, the Panic of 1907 is widely considered the first worldwide financial crisis of the 20th century.
Okay.
The trigger was a series of failures in these things called trust companies. They were financial institutions that acted a lot like banks, but operated completely outside the main clearinghouse safety nets, and they held much lower cash reserves.
So they were doing riskier stuff.
Exactly. When a few of them made bad bets, confidence just evaporated overnight. Depositors lined up around the block to pull their money out. The entire system was literally on the brink of a catastrophic collapse.
Because there was no central public lender of last resort to step in and provide emergency cash.
Right, could stop the panic.
But the Fed didn't exist yet to save them, so a private citizen did. JP Morgan.
Yeah, J.P. Morgan. He essentially locked the most powerful bankers in a room in his private library in New York and, well, bullied them into organizing private rescue lines to inject liquidity into the system.
That is insane.
He basically acted as a one-man central bank.
I am still blown away by this detail. Early 20th century America basically crowdsourced its economic survival to one really rich guy.
Yeah.
It's almost like, I don't know, a major city relying on Batman to run the fire department.
That's a great way to put it.
Right. Like, yeah. It's great when he actually shows up, but you can't just hope the billionaire vigilante happens to be in town when the city catches fire. It is completely unscalable as a civic policy.
What's fascinating here is that the very success of J.P. Morgan's rescue proved exactly why the system was utterly unsustainable. Relying on Wall Street titans to stabilize the national economy was dangerous, sure, but beyond that, it was politically toxic.
Oh, totally.
America has this very deep-rooted political distrust of concentrated financial power. I mean, it traces all the way back to Andrew Jackson vetoing the Second Bank of the United States.
Right. The public was terrified that a central bank would just become this privileged alliance between corrupt politicians and elite financiers.
Precisely. They couldn't just build a centralized top-down bank like the Bank of England. The public wouldn't stand for it.
Which is why the Federal Reserve Act of 1913 was such a massive, messy political compromise.
Yeah, they designed a hybrid system.
Okay.
You have the Board of Governors in Washington, D.C., which provides the, you know, the public national oversight.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have 12 regional reserve banks scattered across the country, places like Dallas, Chicago, San Francisco.
That was so spread out.
The logic there is that an agricultural credit shock in the Midwest looks very different from a manufacturing shock on the East Coast.
Ah, that makes sense.
Those regional banks provide on-the-ground economic intelligence. And finally, you have the New York Fed.
The bridge to Wall Street.
Exactly. It's the operational arm. The New York Fed executes the policy by interacting with the primary dealers, handling global dollar funding, and actually, you know, trading in the open market.
So we have this bizarre, decentralized Frankenstein monster built in 1913. And because it was built as this weird compromise, the way it actually controls the money supply today is vastly different. And honestly, way more indirect than most people assume.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, we hear the phrase, the Fed is printing money all the time. But looking at the mechanics in this dossier, that phrasing is a massive myth.
It is a fundamental misunderstanding of modern central banking. The Fed is not a money printing machine. It is a price setter for short-term money. It controls the marginal price and availability of central bank money, meaning the reserves that banks use to settle payments with each other.
Right.
By anchoring the cost of those reserves, it indirectly influences the price of all private credit created by commercial banks in the real economy.
Let's break down the actual tools they use to do this, because this gets technical.
Yeah.
The primary tool is the federal funds rate, right?
Yes.
As of our current data in mid-June 2026, the target range is sitting at 3.50% to 3.75%. But they don't just wave a magic wand and decree that rate into existence. How do they actually force the free market to stay within that specific range?
They do it through what is called an ample reserves framework.
Ample reserves.
Right. In the old days, the Fed used to buy and sell Treasury securities in small amounts just to tweak the scarce supply of reserves in the banking system, nudging the interest rate up or down.
Just tiny adjustments.
Exactly. But today, the system is absolutely flooded with reserves. Tweaking the supply wouldn't do anything. So instead of adjusting the quantity of money, they use an alphabet soup of administered rates to set a hard floor and a soft ceiling.
Yeah, the sources mentioned two massive acronyms here, IORB and ONRRP.
The alphabet soup.
Exactly. Let's translate those into plain English.
Sure. Let's start with IORB, or interest on reserve balances. This is the interest rate the Fed pays commercial banks simply for keeping their money parked safely at the Federal Reserve.
Just for leaving it there.
Just for leaving it there. Think about the incentive structure here. If the Fed is willing to pay a bank 3.5% risk-free to do absolutely nothing, that bank is never going to lend money to another bank or a business for anything less than 3.5%.
Oh, wow. Yeah, why would they take a risk for less money?
Exactly. It creates an absolute floor for interest rates in the commercial banking sector.
That makes perfect sense for traditional banks. But what about the rest of the financial universe, like the shadow banks, the massive money market funds?
That is where the second tool comes in. The ONRRP, or Overnight Reverse Repo Facility.
Okay.
It does essentially the same thing, but for non-banks. It gives money market funds a risk-free place to park their cash overnight in exchange for treasury collateral.
Oh, wait, really? This is the exact mechanism that you might notice when you open your personal Vanguard or Robinhood account and see your uninvested cash suddenly yielding 4% or 5%.
Yes, exactly.
That isn't magic. That is the OnRRP facility setting a floor under the entire financial system's cash.
Spot on. It extends that interest rate floor out of the traditional banking sector and directly into the broader shadow banking system.
That's wild. Okay, so beyond setting those overnight rates, there is the balance sheet itself. The sources dive heavily into QE and QT, quantitative easing and quantitative tightening.
Right, and if we connect this to the bigger picture, the Fed is fundamentally a balance sheet institution.
Okay.
When a crisis hits and they drop short-term interest rates all the way to zero, they run out of traditional ammunition.
Because they can't go below zero easily.
Right. So they turn to QE. They buy massive amounts of long-term bonds like 10-year treasuries and mortgage-backed securities. The goal is to remove duration risk from the market.
Got it.
QT is the exact reverse process. They let those bonds mature, they pull reserves out of the system, and they force the market to absorb that duration risk again.
Hold on. You said QT forces the market to absorb duration risk. In plain English, does that just mean forcing investors to take on the risk of locking their money up for long periods of time?
Precisely. Look, if you lend someone money for 10 years, you take on the risk that inflation might eat away your returns over that decade.
Right.
Or that interest rates might rise and make your current bond look terrible. That is duration risk. Investors naturally demand a higher yield to take on that risk.
Makes sense.
When the Fed uses QE to buy up all those long-term bonds, they suck that risk out of the market, which forces long-term interest rates down. And that pushes investors into riskier assets like stocks or real estate just to find a decent return.
Oh, so they have to go somewhere else to make money.
Exactly. And when the Fed shifts to QT, they put that risk back into the market, which tightens financial conditions and cools things down.
I'm trying to visualize this whole framework. They aren't printing money. They are just setting the baseline cost of money. It's almost like they don't step on the gas pedal themselves. They just adjust how fast the engine idles.
That is a brilliant way to frame it. They set the idle speed of the economy.
Right.
They set the baseline hum of the engine by managing that overnight rate. But they let the commercial banks actually put the car in gear and drive it, you know, by creating credit, writing mortgages, and funding businesses in the real economy.
So what does this all mean? Now that we know how they adjust that idle speed, we have to look at what they are actually trying to achieve. They are steering this massive economic vehicle toward a specific destination.
Yes, they are steering toward the dual mandate.
The dual mandate.
Congress wrote a law requiring the Fed to promote two specific goals. Stable prices, which the Fed currently defines as a 2% longer-run inflation objective, and maximum employment.
Okay, looking at the June 2026 reality, the Fed is navigating a really tricky landscape. We are in a high-rate post-QE era.
Very tricky.
According to the latest FOMC statement in the dossier, inflation remains elevated relative to that 2% goal, so they are keeping rates restrictive. How does turning that idle speed dial in DC actually hit you and me in the real economy? What is the transmission mechanism?
It ripples through the credit markets.
Okay.
When the Fed raises rates, corporate financing becomes significantly more expensive. So a company looking to build a new factory might delay the project or slow down hiring. That cools wage growth.
Right.
On the consumer side, mortgage rates shoot up, which immediately prices people out of the housing market and cools demand for real estate.
Right.
Credit card debt gets more expensive. Auto loans get more expensive.
Everything gets more expensive to finance.
Exactly. It also disciplines speculative assets. Think about it. If you can get a guaranteed risk-free return in a money market fund, you are suddenly a lot less willing to throw your savings at a highly speculative tech stock or some unproven crypto startup.
Right. Why take the risk? But I have to push back on the inherent contradiction of this mandate.
Okay, sir.
If the Fed raises rates to cool inflation by deliberately making borrowing harder, slowing down corporate hiring, cooling wage growth, aren't they deliberately hurting the exact workers they're supposed to protect under the maximum employment side of the mandate?
Wow.
It sounds like trying to cure a fever by throwing the patient into an ice bath.
You're seeing the brutal dilemma of central banking right there. In a perfect world, inflation and unemployment move in opposite directions, making the job easy.
Right.
But when you have a supply shock, where inflation is high but the economy is simultaneously weakening, the Fed faces a profound crisis of credibility. If they don't throw the patient in the ice bath, the public might lose faith in the Fed's willingness to fight inflation.
And if that happens, the psychology of the entire country shifts.
Exactly. If consumers start to expect high inflation to last forever, they demand higher wages to compensate.
which makes sense for the consumer.
Right. But then companies raise prices to cover those higher wages, and inflation becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. We saw this in the 1970s.
Ah, the wage price spiral.
Exactly. If those inflation expectations break, the Fed has to hike rates even more aggressively later, causing a much deeper, more painful recession. They're basically forced to protect the purchasing power of the currency, even if it guarantees short-term pain in the labor market.
That delicate balancing act makes sense for normal times, but the sources show that when a true existential panic hits, the rule book just gets thrown right out the window.
Oh, completely.
This institution has radically expanded its power over the last century. In 1913, they were a traditional lender of last resort, purely for banks. Yeah. But in the 2008 global financial crisis, and especially the 2020 COVID-19 shock, they morphed into the market maker of last resort.
Yeah, 2008 proved that the financial system had evolved way beyond traditional commercial banking. Mm. The real panic back then was happening in the shadow banking sector.
Right, the investment banks.
Investment banks, complex mortgage securities, money market funds. If the Fed had only rescued traditional commercial banks, the global system still would have completely collapsed.
Wow.
So they created massive emergency lending facilities and bought non-traditional assets just to stop the fire sales.
And then 2020 happened.
Right. Then in 2020, COVID-19 wasn't even a financial crisis at first. It was a sudden stop of the physical economy.
Yeah, everything just halted.
But the Fed moved instantly. They cut rates to zero, restarted massive QE, propped up corporate credit, and established swap lines globally to just flood the world with dollars.
They essentially put a concrete floor under the entire financial universe.
They did.
But looking at the long-term effects of that, I see a really dangerous cycle forming. These crisis interventions sound like a financial version of strong antibiotics.
Interesting.
Like they cure the immediate deadly infection, like the sudden economic stop of 2020, but they breed superbugs.
Ah, I see what you mean.
You get rampant asset inflation, over-leveraged shadow banks, and this deep-seated moral hazard because investors realize the Fed will always save them. And that means the next time a crisis hits, you need even stronger, riskier medicine to fix it.
This raises an important question about the limits of monetary policy, because the rescue logic definitely works in the short term. It prevents a second Great Depression.
Sure.
But the risk logic you just described is severe. When the central bank constantly guarantees market functioning, it inflates asset valuations much faster than actual household incomes.
Right. The rich just get richer on paper.
Exactly. And it blurs the line between technocratic monetary policy and just picking winners and losers in the market. That inevitably leads to intense political pressure and explosive distributional tension.
Oh, absolutely.
And note that this isn't about taking a political side. Both ends of the political spectrum heavily criticize the Fed during these cycles.
Mm-hmm.
But purely as a matter of economic mechanics, massive interventions create massive public scrutiny.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Because the global economy is so hyper-interconnected, the side effects of that heavy central bank medicine don't just stay isolated to Wall Street or Washington, D.C.
No, they don't.
They ripple outward and dictate the value of literally every asset you own all over the world. The sources gave us a really fascinating map of this asset class transmission.
Yeah, the Fed's policy doesn't just hit one button. It changes discount rates, liquidity, leverage, and risk premia across the board.
And risk premia is just the extra return an investor demands for taking a risk instead of sitting in cash, right?
Exactly. Take real estate, for example. It's highly sensitive because it relies on leverage and long-duration cash flows. Fed policy directly moves capitalization rates.
Let's define capitalization rates for the listener, because that sounds like heavy industry jargon.
Sure. Think of a capitalization rate, or cap rate, as the yield a property generates.
Okay.
If a commercial building generates $100,000 a year in profit, and safe treasury yields are sitting at 1%, investors will happily pay millions of dollars for that building.
Because 1% is nothing.
Right. But if the Fed raises safe rates to 5%, that building's 1% return looks terrible.
Yeah, I'd rather just take the 5% risk-free.
Exactly. So investors demand a higher cap rate to justify the risk, which means the underlying value of the property must plummet.
It's just a mechanical repricing of the physical world. What about gold? Because the traditional wisdom is that it's just an inflation hedge.
It is much more complex than that. Gold actually competes with real interest rates.
How so?
Well, if the Fed raises rates and the real return on a treasury bond after accounting for inflation is high, the opportunity cost of holding gold goes up because gold pays no interest.
Ah, right. It just sits there.
Exactly. However, gold is also a hedge against monetary and geopolitical distrust. So even in a high-rate environment, if global confidence in fiat institutions falls, gold can still rise.
Okay, so if gold reacts to a loss of faith in traditional institutions, how does a purely digital rebellion against fiat currency like Bitcoin react when the Fed turns the dials?
Bitcoin is caught in a fascinating tug of war. On one hand, it is highly sensitive to the Fed's liquidity spigot. When the Fed tightens, it drains speculative leverage from the system, which violently pulls capital away from risk assets like crypto.
The liquidity dries up.
Right. But on the other hand, Bitcoin thrives on a narrative of fiat currency debasement. So it reacts to both the raw mathematical reality of tightening liquidity and the broader psychology of monetary trust.
We have to zoom out even further, past U.S. borders. The Fed isn't just a domestic manager. A hawkish Fed, one that is aggressively raising rates, strengthens the U.S. dollar and raises treasury yields.
Yes, it does.
And looking at the data, that absolutely crushes emerging market currencies.
A strong dollar forces foreign central banks into incredibly tight corners. The dossier uses the Bank of Korea as a prime example of this mechanism.
Okay, let's walk through that.
If the Fed hikes rates, global capital naturally flows into the U.S. to capture those higher yields. This strengthens the dollar, which mechanically weakens the Korean won.
Right.
Because critical global commodities like oil are priced in dollars, Korea suddenly has to pay much more in their local currency just to import energy.
They are importing inflation simply because the dollar got stronger.
Exactly. So the Bank of Korea might be forced to raise their own interest rates to defend their currency and fight off that imported inflation, even if their own domestic economy is sputtering and actually needs lower rates.
Wow. When a committee in D.C. tweaks a decimal point, a semiconductor exporter in Seoul instantly feels the pinch. It's incredible.
It really is.
The Fed is the gravitational center of a financial solar system. All these distinct assets, U.S. stocks, real estate, gold, Bitcoin, emerging market currencies, they are just planets being violently pulled in and out of orbit by the sheer mass of the Fed's balance sheet.
And that gravitational pull is exactly what sustains U.S. dollar hegemony. Yeah. The entire global system relies on this Fed plumbing. During panics, the Fed uses dollar swap lines to essentially lend dollars to foreign central banks, acting as the ultimate global backstop. They provide the deep liquidity and the rule of law credibility that underpins all of global finance. I'd ask you to consider, what stands out to you when you realize your local housing market is tied to the exact same plumbing system backing foreign central banks?
It's a really heavy realization. We started this deep dive talking about a thermostat, but we've seen that the Federal Reserve is not just some plastic dial on the wall.
Definitely not.
It is a complex, living network of laws, balance sheets, and historical compromises. It constantly balances on the razor's edge of price stability and financial stability, and its decisions transmit through every single layer of your financial life.
It is the operating architecture of dollar capitalism, constantly balancing inflation against employment and necessary rescue against dangerous moral hazard.
Which leaves us with a final thought to mull over. We talked about those financial antibiotics and the moral hazard they create.
Yeah, the superbugs.
Right. The Fed has successfully played market maker of last resort for the last two decades. But what happens if the global economy becomes so utterly addicted to these central bank backstops that a future crisis is simply too large for the Fed's political or financial capacity to absorb?
That is the big question.
What happens to global capitalism if the ultimate financial superbug arrives and the Fed's medicine simply stops working? Next time you adjust the thermostat in your house, you might want to wonder, what happens when the wires finally burn out?